other words, it's acting as if the sun suddenly has more gravity. It's slowing down. It's only one part in 4,000, but it is slowing down too fast, if you know what I mean, Paul. So it's still going to, it's definitely got escape velocity. It's really going for the star Aldebaran. It's going to get there in 2 million years. And in theory, somebody 2 million years from now are going to look at that plaque on the side of Pioneer 10 and 11 and say, boy, these primitive guys, they do make a nice piece of hardware, and it worked for 34 years. It continuously, with its nuclear power source on board, continuously transmitted signals back to the Earth and gave us some very nice measurements. Well-designed, long-lived piece of hardware, and that downlink signal is coming from a traveling wave tube. To design a traveling wave tube that continuously works for 34 years, that's a good trick. Well-designed piece of hardware, from my point of view, by our standards. So, 8,000 miles, too little distance per year. Back to you, Paul, KQLIW.
Okay. Very good. I was thinking, okay, they weren't taking into consideration the, everything starts to slow down because of the pull of the gravity from the sun. You go back to the Apollo days, remember when they used to go to the moon and they said, well, they've got to go 25,000 miles an hour to break Earth orbit. 17,500 full orbit. Escape velocity was 25,000 miles per hour, 7 miles a second. And then people did the math real quick, and they said, why is it taking 3-4 days to get there? Oh, my goodness, something's wrong. You know, 25,000, 250,000, they should be there in 10 hours, you know. But they didn't realize they would slow down to as little as 4,000 miles per hour as they're cruising to, to gradually slowing down. And then they pick up speed when they get close to the moon. So I was thinking maybe that. The only other possibility would be, you know, these things are getting close to the heliopause, and if this is happening with Voyager as well, maybe that could be the problem, the heliopause being the area where the you're officially winding up into galactic space, breaking free from the gravity well of the our star system. That might have something to do with it, Dick. There's a barrier there where the solar wind creates this barrier. It's a blast barrier. In fact, they've pointed the instruments of Voyager toward that and tried to get different readings. They still do that now and then to try to pick up the exact area where the heliopause is. They'll be able to tell with the instruments on board. So maybe that has something to do with it. I really don't know, Dick. Back to you.
WA2VDH with a comment. WA2VDH. We'll pick up with you in a second. The heliopause is where the solar wind essentially stops. The solar wind, the sun is continuously boiling off high-velocity particles. Many of those particles come flying out of the sun at roughly 1 million miles an hour in the Earth vicinity. And as they spread further out, they also slow down because they're continuously, each of those particles is continuously being acted upon by the solar gravity. And the so-called heliopause, which I guess is a little bit beyond the orbit of Pluto, is the place where the solar wind essentially stops, and what's left over after that is the so-called galactic wind as opposed to solar wind. And we're talking about very, very few particles as far as what the spacecraft is encountering. And the chance of those particles being slowing it down is very unlikely. You've got particle impact detectors, which I think are essentially microphones, on the spacecraft, on many of these outer spacecraft, that measure those particle impacts. So you know how big are the particles and how often you're impacting them, and that's not the source of slowdown. Is it the leakage of a gas from a tank? Very unlikely. Is it the power being dissipated by the nuclear power generator? Well, they did a quick calculation of that, and the answer comes out much too small and aimed in the wrong direction, that would be speeding it up. The nuclear power generator on board started off at something like 2,500 watts. It's now down to something like 70 watts of output after 36 years. And when you're out that far, putting solar cells on the spacecraft are out of the question. Your Cassini spacecraft, for instance, is running on a nuclear power generator. Because when you're that far away from the sun, you get too little power out of the best solar cells you can muster. And it wouldn't be enough power to run the spacecraft. But these are long-range unmanned space probes, as I see it, are making some beautiful measurements, taking some fantastic pictures, and mailing it all back home. It's nice to dream about, let me drop. It's nice to dream about mankind being out there. But if you do a quick calculation of what is required to maintain life as we know it on a spacecraft, it is tremendously more difficult than you would ever imagine. As I've said so often, we all take for granted what Mother Earth is supplying to us. If I measured the amount of oxygen, water, and food that you consume in 1 year, it has the volume of your house, it has the mass of your house. Very rough numbers. So your house volume and your house mass is what you consume in 1 year. If I send you on a 3-year mission to Mars and back, I have to supply you 3 housefuls worth of stuff to maintain your life as you know it. That's an extremely difficult problem. Whereas you design a well-designed spacecraft like Spirit and Opportunity, it can go there for years on end. You don't have to give it oxygen, water, and food. You don't have to worry about all of its waste products and recycling and whatever. You get a lot more bang for the money. And you send a man to Mars, your chances of getting him back alive, the chance of getting him back in a state that's useful, where all of that radiation he's being exposed to for all of those years and all of the damage that creates to all of his DNA, that's probably not very tolerable by our current standards. We haven't really solved that problem. Once you're under the Van Allen belt of this planet, inside of our magnetic field, and under our atmosphere, you're getting a tremendous amount of protection from all of those cosmic rays, solar wind, nuclear radiation, and everything else coming out of that sun. All kinds of stuff, x-rays and ultraviolet, whatever. A lot of stuff you're exposed to when you're in the vacuum of space above our atmosphere. You don't want to go there unless you're very well protected. WA2UDH, I think it is. Oh, yes. Talked to you earlier. Boy, am I forgetful. Where did I write that one down? Sounds like you've got some further information. Go right ahead, sir. Tell me your name again, because I'm so forgetful. KQLIW.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Yeah, the handle is John. Name's John. WA2 Victor David Henry. Just a comment. As I understand it, the heliopause is where the outgoing solar wind, basically what you said, the outgoing solar wind meets the interstellar medium. I don't know if it's actually a barrier per se, but I guess that those particles, as you say, do slow down to a stop, but I don't think there's any kind of barrier. The other comment I had was that most of the stuff I've seen about dark matter, this is from Astronomy Picture of the Day, I've seen on dark matter, they've measured it at intergalactic distances. I guess at some point it must start becoming measurable at interstellar distance and possibly even smaller. I mean, there shouldn't be anything unique about our solar system as far as the rest of the distribution of the galaxy. So if dark matter is distributed, it should be within our own system also. Go ahead, Dick.
I very much agree with you, John. I think there's nothing magic about our particular solar system. If there's dark matter distributed throughout the Milky Way, our galaxy, and all of the local galaxies that we've already made these measurements on, if that dark matter is so darn universal, then it's certainly going to be ubiquitous as I see it, with rare exception, and it's going to be within our solar system. I'm troubled by the fact that I didn't read of all the proposed examples of all the proposed explaining the anomaly, that one wasn't mentioned, or at least I don't remember it being mentioned. I'm a little bit worried that if we do a calculation for the known amount of dark matter, it wouldn't be enough to explain what's going on at a within a solar system. So if that's not it, and they've looked at an awful lot of other proposals, it's one hell of a mystery. And it's something we'd like to know about, because we're going to be sending up the spacecraft. I think it is time that we recalculate each of the known planets in the solar system. I mean, up till now, that error that I'm talking about is a 0.02% error in position and velocity of Pioneer 10 and 11. We could easily have 0.02% of error in the position and velocities of the outer planets of the solar system. And up till now, it wouldn't be noticed, so to speak, because everything hangs together. They're all under the exact same influence if it was dark matter within our solar system. So I think it's time we recalculate what's going on with the known planets of the solar system. I haven't heard anyone propose to do that, but I think it's time. And we either do or don't get a confirmation of the philosophy of the proposal of it being dark matter within the solar system. Fun stuff. Whenever you make measurements with the right kind of instrumentation, you get a whole lot of answers, and if you're objective enough, you're going to get a whole lot of brand new questions. And the way mankind makes progress, from my point of view, is by having curiosity. Let me drop. We amateurs, and what's discussed on the TechNet, I think in many cases, is a display of our curiosity. We're curious about radio, transmission lines, antennas, meteor scatter, moon bounce, all of the aurora communication, field of line anomalies, ionospheric reflection. We're curious about the wireless techniques. We're curious about the way digital television works, the way the satellites work, the way NASA's spacecraft work. We're curious about a lot of things. And curiosity is very good. That's how mankind makes progress. You find me a society that has no curiosity, and I'll show you a stagnant society that's no longer progressing, is a belief of mine. So these anomalies, as we discover them, you can easily say, well, it's just an error in the data. This is outdated, and I'll throw it away. Well, in many cases, you're throwing away the baby with the wash water if you do that. If you're a sufficiently objective scientist, there's no such thing as bad data. Every bit of data is telling you something. It may be telling you an error, and maybe it's a systematic error within your instrumentation, and you ought to know about that. Or in most cases, an awful lot of serendipity happens because somebody says, gee, that error, what the hell caused that? Let's dig in a little bit deeper, and you start making discoveries. And a hell of a lot of discoveries come about from that kind of view. So Mother Nature is telling us something on Pioneer 10 and 11. The message is there. We haven't gotten the message yet. Reasonably strong message. It's well inside of, way inside of the measurement error of that ranging system of the Deep Space Network of NASA. 0.02% error. When they can resolve position to 1 part in 10 to the 10, and we're talking about 1 part in 10 to the 4. So 2 parts in 10 to the 4, but you know what I mean. Way inside the measurement error. So I doubt it's measurement error. As I said, you read this article and you find out people have spent a good fraction of a career studying where is the error. Double check the instrumentation, the people who did the design, the people who made the measurements, the various media on which all the measurements were made, and it all tracks. It's not that somebody had a hard drive running at the wrong rate or whatever. That's just one of the techniques for recording over all of these 34 years. Anyone with any further...
Repeater, time out.
Anyone...
Glad to end.
Anyone with any further questions or comments? Paul recognized. Give me a call, let us right now.
Tango Delta Lima with a question.
Tango Delta Lima. We'll get to you right after Paul. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, one thing I was saying about the heliopause before is because you've got these cosmic rays, the solar wind coming from the sun, and hitting the spacecraft from behind. So, I mean, that's all figured in. They've already figured out that the solar wind will actually make a spacecraft move. If it just was floating out there, it will actually make it move. It can make it turn a little bit. You know, it's a real thing that hits the spacecraft. So if the solar wind hits the heliopause, because you've got the galactic solar wind out there, I would say that the particles will hit that heliopause, and a lot of them are going to reverse and start coming back the other way. And when they come back the other way, they could be hitting the spacecraft from the other direction. You know, and 8,000 miles per year really isn't all that much when these things are traveling at 20 and 30,000 miles per hour. So, I don't know, maybe, I'm thinking maybe the particles coming back. But if they didn't mention it, so I guess nobody thought of it yet. So that's what I would go with. I can't believe it's dark matter. It sure can't be dark energy. I think it would be going the other way. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to have to reread the article, Paul. I think the anomaly of 8,000 miles per year began long before the spacecraft left the solar system. So it started happening inside of the place where the solar wind was already pushing it from the back, if you know what I mean. The spacecraft is slowing down, and until it hit the heliopause, which is beyond Pluto, the solar wind was pushing it out, not slowing it down. So the solar wind explanation seems to be in the wrong direction. I had the impression from the article, as I'd read it, that well inside of the solar system, the anomaly was already being recognized. And that's the reason why I think it's time we recalculate our outer planets' positions and velocities, is there's something funny going on there. Because if there really is extra dark matter within unknown, unrecognized dark matter within our solar system, it would have to be affecting the velocities and positions of the outer planets. And because it's two parts in 10 to the 4, I'm not sure that the outer planets have been calculated that accurately up till now. But by way of Hubble Space Telescope and the James Webb is the new one, the infrared telescope, I can't think of the name of it right now, by way of those pieces.
Yeah, Kepler one?
Kepler is one of them. Well, Kepler is not making that kind of measure. The infrared telescope that's in space right now, why can't I think of the name of that one, Paul? Go ahead.
Spitzer.
That's the one. Okay, with the instrumentation we've got on the ground and in space, we can now decide to go back and look with higher accuracy how are our outer planets behaving. Do they also show an anomaly? Now that we know what to look for, we know with what accuracy to look for. Mr. Tango Delta Lima, is it Whiskey Alpha 2 Tango Delta Lima? Thought it was your name, sir, and your question or comment. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, it's Kilo Charlie 2 Tango Delta Lima. I'm portable right now, so you may be getting me weak. Can I get a signal report?
Yeah, John, from Lindbergh. Your portable is doing a medium good job. You're 80% voice, 20% noise, but go right ahead with your question or comment, John.
Yes, I recently got a bike, a new very, very good bike, new bike, and I also have a mobile radio, you know, 2440, Yaesu, FT-7800, and I was wondering if I could attach a battery to, you know, get a portable unit on my bike, attach a 9-volt battery to my mobile unit via the bike, but on transmission, the radio consumes 8.5 amperes. However, you know, the circuit I wanted to build only provides a maximum of 1.5 amperes. Let me let it drop. And that would be relatively problematic for me because, you know, I need at least 10 amperes. Then I came across another circuit. Instead of using a 7812, the IC was 7812, I decided to use a 7.3. I can't find a 7.3, but that was much better because it said using optional power transistors, I could get 10 amps. But I don't know. What's your idea on this? How could I get 10 amps, 12 volts of power using a 9 volt battery? Because, you know, I don't want to attach too much stuff to my bike.
Let me ask you this one, John. Isn't the lead acid battery that runs the starter motor on your bike, when you say bike, I presume that means motorcycle, a two-wheel vehicle, isn't that already a 12-volt battery? Back to you, John.
No, this is literally a bike, something you have to pedal. No, this isn't a motorbike. This is a manual pedal bike, and I don't want to add too much stuff to it to make it too heavy.
Okay. Since you are now adding a battery to that bicycle, what's making you choose a 9-volt battery instead of a 12-volt battery? Back to you, John.
I thought it would be more convenient, it'd be smaller, and also it'd be nice to use, because, you know, a 12-volt battery can be very large and also pretty pricey.
If I had the free rein of choosing the kind of battery, whether it be nickel-cadmium, if I want rechargeable, nickel-metal hydride, lithium, lithium polymer. There's lots and lots of kinds of batteries. Nothing magic about 9 volts versus 12 volts. And to get 8 amperes out of a battery for brief periods of time for transmitting is not too difficult. So whether I choose a 9 volt, your biggest problem is to have enough total capacity in watt hours. You can call it ampere hours if you like, but it's really watt hours. It takes a certain number of watts to run that transmitter that you like in the transmit mode. And do you really have to transmit that number of watts? That's another whole question. But you've chosen a certain number of watts, and so you get more bang for the dollar, so to speak, out of 12-volt batteries in total watt hours versus a 9-volt battery. I think that may be a wash. There are, if you do enough search, there are circuits that'll take any voltage input, either any voltage output, and almost any ampere output you want, if you choose the right circuit. But the problem of taking a 9-volt battery and inverting that up to 12 volts, in other words, it's some kind of an inverter that steps up the voltage, and then you have to filter it and whatever, to go through all that rigmarole to get 12 volts output, as opposed to starting with 12 volts to begin with in the battery, it is my guess that if you do enough study, you'll be way ahead of the game to start off with a 12-volt battery. If you have fallen in love with a particular 9-volt battery, then use a 9-volt battery and put it in series with another 3-volt battery, or maybe a 4-volt battery, and run it on 13 volts. Many of the so-called 12-volt circuits really want 13 volts to run on, because the cigarette lighter, so to speak, of your automobile, when the main engine is running, really has 13.5 volts there. So there's a number of radios that you and I can buy. Just let me drop. That are rated for 12 volts in as far as the data sheet is concerned, but they really want 13.5. My ICOM 731, I think it is, says it runs on 12 volts. It's made to run in an automobile. It's a 2-meter all-mode rig, 1985 vintage. When I go below 11.9 volts, it starts going crazy. Internal regulators drop out. If I was really using a 12-volt battery and I had the half a volt of drop in the voltage of my wiring, I'd never be able to run that rig very well in the transmit mode, even on a 12-volt battery. So you got to worry about some of those details. As you design or choose a battery and or voltage regulating circuit for your particular transmitter, I do recommend you connect it to a power supply, where you can slowly lower the voltage on the power supply down to, let's say, 11.9, 11.8, 11.7 volts. Find out at what exact voltage going into that rig. Does it start misbehaving? As I told you, my particular transmitter is 11.9 volts. It goes crazy. So you want to know that. And that's going to make a big difference on how you choose a battery and how you choose a voltage regulator circuit. I haven't given you an answer, as you can tell, John. But I think I've told you some of the variables involved. Sounds like a fun project. I'd like you to check in periodically and tell us how it's gone with you and what progress you've made. KC2, Tango Delta Lima, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
M2EO is the information they give you to take.
Okay, Rich recognized. Was there another person?
K2KEY.
Rich and Mel in that order. So maybe we got some more information here for you, John. N2EO, go right ahead, Rich.
Hey, Dick, you know what he could use for a small volt battery? If it'll run on 12, I don't know the exact voltage, it's called a 12 volt battery. An alarm battery that they use for backup systems on alarms. He could go to a supplier of fire alarms, burglar alarms, any type of place that sells alarm equipment, and buy an alarm battery for about $10 or $15. I believe that Gel sells a very small. I know I have an Elecraft K2 that I built, and they have an option for that radio to run off a Gel cell. And I believe it's nothing more than an alarm battery. That's the first thing. Second thing, the 723 regulators are very available. Radio Shack doesn't have them. Let me alert a reset. Okay, I just bought some 723 regulators for 56 cents a piece. I bought them from Mouths of Electronics. Go online, they don't have a minimum order. M-O-U-S-E-R, Mouser Electronics, among many other places, have the 723. You may see it called an LM-723 or a CP-1723. It's all the same 723 regulator. The third thing I wanted to mention, I don't know the guy's call letters, but if he can find out, there's a gentleman in England who rides around on a bicycle with a 100-watt mobile rig. I've spoken to him a number of times. I wish I could remember the fellow's call. But if he can maybe get hold and find out who that gentleman is and email him or talk to him, he could probably give him a lot of information. Back to that, N2EO.
Don, good suggestions, and I thank you, Rich. When I was stationed out at Edwards Air Force Base in California a few years ago, every morning I used to talk to a particular guy while I'm running mobile from the rental car with my 723 Kenwood 2-meter all mode. Is it 723? I'm looking at the model number right now. Boy, it's well hidden on the front panel. Anyhow, 751. TR-751A, 2-meter all mode, running from the cigarette lighter of the rental automobile. So every morning I was talking to this guy, and he's talking back to me. We had a nice conversation. It went on for a couple of weeks. I eventually discovered that he was on a motorcycle traveling to his place of business each morning, and I never heard any wind noise or whatever in the background. He had designed the microphone, earphone, audio system that was inside of his helmet. He did such a beautiful job that it sounded like he was in a nice, quiet living room talking to me each morning. Gives you some hints of what can be done. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, Rich actually said exactly almost what I was going to say. I used to operate, bike mobile many times with a two-wheeler. No, not a motorcycle, just a regular pedal bike. And I operated HF, UHF, VHF. I've done everything on the bike. I do it only once a year mostly now because I take my bike and use it on patrolling on the New York City Marathon. And my battery supply is one of those batteries that Rich just mentioned, used in the alarm system. It's made by USA. We used to use a lot of these batteries. The company is YUASA, known as USA or USA. And the battery I have right here, I'm looking at it, it's called the NTA-12. It's an 8 ampere, 12-volt battery, sealed, rechargeable, lead-acid battery. And it fits right on my little carrier, a little carrier in the back of behind the seat. It's not too bad in weight, and it fits right on there. And in the past, I have used a 706. A ICOM 706 Mark II G, which is an all mode, all band radio, and I've had it. I used it on HF, I've used it on VHF, UHF, and everything. I've used a number of different radios on the bike, so I have a mounting. I have an actual mounting that I've installed that the whip antenna goes on with Dick, and I have a wire with a connector that goes right up along the bar of the bike, and a plate, a mounting plate, right on the front handlebars where the radio connects onto. So this battery, I could say, does the job very sufficiently, and it's very reasonable price, as Rich said. Back to you, Dick.
N2RSO with info.
N2RSO recognized, but before we go to you, Mel, back to you. What frequency did you use that bike mobile on? Because I'm anticipating the next question John's going to have is, what's the best antenna to use? What frequency did you use, and what antenna did you use on your bicycle, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
As I said, I operate, you know, VHF, UHF, which I still use every year during the New York City Marathon. But the HF that I operate was mostly at that time on 20 meters, and 20 and 10 meters, actually. And what I did is I used actually the coils for the Neutronic Hustler whip, modified version. I made another version of the whip up, a little lightweight, a lighter different, a little different mounting situation for the bike. But I was able to make the adapters up at the top so I could still screw in and use the Neutronics loading coils, Dick, over.
Okay, sounds very good. Frank, I think, is next, N2RSO. Go right ahead, Frank.
Yes, good evening, Dick. This is Frank, N2RSO. Just as a follow-up to what Rich, N2EO, said, those batteries are also made for emergency exit lighting. Approximately the same size. They run about $12-$15 a piece. And if you don't want to wait for them to be delivered and ordering on the internet, just go to your local Home Depot electrical department and you'll find them sitting right up on the shelf. I'm guessing that Lowe's probably carries them as well, but I haven't really looked for them there. Back to you, Dick, and to RSO.
So as you can tell, John, some other advice is, if at all possible, try to keep it simple. To take on the problem of a proper installation of good antenna, the radio, properly shock mounting the antenna, your main source of power, and there you care most about what voltage and what hours it can deliver for the number of hours you want to operate in the transmit mode with that rig. To not have to make a fancy voltage converting circuit is something worth fighting for, as I see it. Try to keep it a little bit simple. You've got a number of challenges to make this all work as well as you'd like to. And we'd like to hear from you time to time as you make progress on this project, John. KC2, Tango Delta Lima, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Oh, also, I moved to the basement. I'm on my mobile rig now. You should get me better. I hear what you're saying. What I'm really worried about is the life of the battery, because if I do a non-transitory, really long operation, really long transmission, it's, you know, probably going to drain the battery, and money's not a thing I got too much of these days. So, you know, I'm going to have to keep a battery with a really long life. Or maybe what I was thinking is I could add an alternator to the bike, and as I pedal, it can maybe add power, you know, back to the battery. But, you know, like you said, keep it simple. Yeah, I'm trying to keep something within an Altoids tin. Yeah, that's how simple I'm trying to make it. But, you know, I hear what you said, and I'll certainly try to work on it. You know, keep it simple.
Put two or three batteries in parallel for the current rating. You'll get, they're not that heavy, and they're not that big, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of advantages, I see it, John, of using 12-volt batteries, because to recharge one, guarantee there are more things in your house, like the cigarette lighter of the car battery system, and whatever, that will directly charge a 12-volt battery. That's one simple thing. The radio is made for 12 volts. your main concern is the number of watt-hours of the battery. There's nothing magic about 9 volts producing more watt-hours. So the number of cubic inches of battery in general chooses the decides the number of watt-hours you're good for. So once you've chosen a battery technology, like lead acid or gel cell, you need a specific number of cubic inches in order to get the number of watt-hours you need. To generate it directly, I don't recommend that. I think you said you're going to be drawing 8 amperes at 12 volts. That's over 100 watts, nearly 100 watts, and that's a seventh of a horsepower. Are your legs going to create a seventh of a horsepower to run the generator, to run your transmitter, at the same time you have enough power left over to pedal up that hill that's in front of you? That's a tough one. I think you're better off running on the battery than with the generator from your leg power. That's my belief on that one, John. KC2, Tango Delta Lima, K2RIW.
All right. You know, maybe I'll stick with the batteries. But, you know, anything's possible. I'll keep it simple. Also, another question. I also work with a crystal radio set, as I've heard before, in the TechNet. And I was wondering, could you use an LED as a substitution for a Galena crystal or a diode detector?
I think the answer is no. One of the nicest diodes we used to use in the old days, other than the 1N23 or 1N21 point contact diodes, was a 1N34 germanium diode. Take 2/10 of a volt to make it start conducting in the forward mode. Light-emitting diodes require higher voltage. Yes, they are a diode, but they're made with an entirely different purpose in mind. You put a significant number of volts across the diode, and it generates light for you. So, as a rectifier, at RF frequencies, I think the chances are very slim that a light-emitting diode is going to do much of the job that you're looking for. Now, if Glenn was present, KC2QIQ, he'd be able to make a guess on that one. Now, Glenn, do you happen to be present? Because you work with LEDs every day. K2RIW? Yeah, I think Glenn's already gone to bed. We're beyond his... is that you, Glenn? No, I guess it wasn't. So, I think it's unlikely that the light-emitting diode will do what you want for that one, John. Back to you, John, for any other final.
No, I just must have read somewhere, I think somewhere online, that an LED will light up if you use a certain length of, like, dipole or something, a certain length of antenna on a certain frequency to receive, like, a perfectly tuned signal. It will light up, and it will detect the signal. I must have read that somewhere. Also, another question. I am using broadcast digital television converter box. I just installed a coaxial cable. I replaced the, the window line. Window line, I think that's what it's called. And I'm using coaxial cable to the TV, to the converter box. I was wondering, does coaxial cable make a difference in the signal strength? Because according to the DTV box, it did. I was wondering, does it make any significant difference whether you're using window line or coax?
Are you using an outdoor antenna for direct over-the-air digital satellite reception? Is that what you're describing, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm using an outdoor antenna. It's secure to the chimney.
Okay. Now, the antenna itself maybe was designed for 300 ohm transmission line, balanced transmission line. And in the old days, the 300 ohm transmission line was within the reasonable cost criteria. It was one of the lowest loss transmission lines available back in the 70s. Nowadays, some of the better foam-filled coax cables heavily challenge that, and they have lower loss. So the total amount of insertion loss for the length of transmission line you're running from your rooftop antenna down to the converter, that's what counts, total number of dB of loss. So as you go to each of the various transmission lines you can buy, you go to the right data sheet, and they'll tell you decibels of loss per 100 feet at your favorite frequency. Even if the antenna itself was made for 300 ohms, and the low loss transmission line you choose happens to be 70 ohm, something like RG6SAT type cable that you can get from Radio Shack, a pretty good quality cable, RG6/SAT. To convert from 300 ohms to 70 right at the antenna, Radio Shack will sell you a little device that'll do that. And then the 70 ohm cable itself, in most cases, is made to go directly into the television or the converter box. Most modern equipment has a 70 ohm F connector coaxial input. So your first choice is what feed line has the lowest loss, and coax is a lot easier to live with than twin lead as far as a proper use. Like, you'd be amazed how many people have started off with twin lead coax cable because in the old days it had low loss. They lay it under the rug, they put tacks in the middle of it to make sure it doesn't move, and the tacks are creating insertion loss. So there's a million ways you can misuse twin lead coax cable. As long as you don't pinch it, and as long as you don't put sharp objects through it, it can survive a lot of grief. So your first priority is to choose a low-loss line. Your second priority is to impedance match the two ends of it, if required. Back to you, John, K2RIW.
Yeah, thanks for that. It's late. You know, I got to get up tomorrow, so I'm going to be up in it. But thank you for answering my questions. I may be on next week with a new batch of them, because I'm always working with really small-scale electronics. Not surface mount, but, you know, I try to work with ICs and transistors. But thank you. KC2TDO.
M2EO, Dick.
Very fine, John. Go ahead, Rich.
Before John runs, I was going to suggest, you know, Google answers everything. I wish I could remember the call letters of that gentleman in England who runs Bicycle Mobile. I've spoken to him at least three times, not recently. He had a good signal from England when the band was open. From a bicycle, maybe if you go into Google and type, play around with the wording, but Bicycle Ham Radio Mobile in England, see if you come up with this guy's name and call letters and send him an email. Yeah, Dick.
There's an even easier approach. John's going to be back next week. Quite possibly that guy operating Bicycle Mobile is listed in your logbook. So maybe by next week you'll find that entry of when you talked to him with his call letters. Back to you, Rich.
You know, Dick, I wish that was the case. I don't keep a logbook anymore because it's not required, and I don't go chasing DX, so I keep scratch paper, and the scratch paper eventually gets thrown out.
But when you go to sleep tonight, you're going to say, what was that guy's call letters? Oh, yeah. Keep a little notepad alongside of the bed. Write down those call letters the next time it recurs to you, Rich. Back to you, Rich.
Absolutely, Dick. Well, if John comes back next week, I'm going to go on Google and see if I can find it for him. Because this gentleman was pretty proud of the fact that he had a good signal into the States from England, riding his bicycle. I'm sure he'd love to share his information. Think of this time, I got a quick question from him.
Okay. Before I pass it back, as I pass it back to you, Rich, what band did you talk to him on, Bicycle Mobile, the guy in England? And go ahead with your question.
And I remember it was 20 meters.
Fire away with your question, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Mel, talking about Mobile, I was thinking of this earlier. You know, I have an Icon 7000 in the car, and, I used to run a Hustler mobile whip with resonators for 80 meters, 20 meters, and 10 meters. I went to an antenna from Australia. What do they call it? The Outbacker. And it never occurred to me, but I kept saying, geez, bands are terrible, at least when I get in the car. And I heard some guys talking recently saying that the Outbacker is more or less a dummy load. I never ran any tests on it. I wonder if you have in those shootouts that you guys run, if you've ever checked the Outbacker, And the problem I had with the Hustler was mainly 80 meters. The resonator was so top-heavy, it kept folding back the ball mount that's mounted on the left rear quarter panel of the car. The older ball mounts from the 50s, 60s, and 70s had teeth, so they would grab better. The newer ball mounts use a piece of rubber as friction. I'd go down the road and the antenna would lay back if I had the 80-meter resonator on it. Back to that, and to Leo.
You got it, Mel.
Righto, this is K2KEY, you're 100% right. That's what I have on. I have my my personal car. Don't give me in. I'm getting a dirty look because my XY out here says she wouldn't get into it. But MC sitting here, my cat here, who loves the TechNet, says it's a wonderful car. So you see, you're outvoted. That's just a little humor on my side here. But, Rich, yeah, I have the, on my Chevy, I have it loaded with stuff. And, I have the big old mount, the big old spring mount on that back top of the quarter panel in the back, right up just near the rear window. And the Hustler whip sticks on top of that. And yes, in all the Mobile shootouts, this thing is always won. The Hustler always came out. My Mobile has always been the top signal Mobile. But I've done a lot of other things to, you know, make the improvement of my ground straps down to the chassis and all kinds of things, and all a big piece of a reinforcement plate inside there that I forged to fit the contour of the inside of the quarter panel. So what I've done is bolted the bottom support of the mount with the three bolts, the three-quarter 20s go into this plate that I tapped. This plate has actually been tapped for a quarter 20 thread to beat the quarter inch steel plate. So this all makes a very rigid mount. And it works out really well. It really satisfies my Mobile. Well, I got another antenna system on that I'll describe. The other antenna I have is for VHF UHF. That's a separate mount. That's its mount. I got this universal idea of making a mount that bolts to the chassis and sticks out sort of on the corner, the other corner opposite where this one is, the Neutronics is. And that mount also is a very sturdy mount. And I showed it to a number of people because a lot of new cars, you just can't put these mounts on, the old spring mount on it. It just can't be done anymore. So I showed them this chassis mount. A couple of guys I see have already gotten those that bolts to the chassis and hangs out the sort of the corner. And it has also a spring on it. And you could also put the Hustler whip on it. It's quite solid if you use the right material. So that's basically the Mobile setup on this end here. And, oh, I've worked with a number of people, bike Mobile. I mean, gee, I don't know. I have to look, come up with their call letters, but I've been bike mobiling and worked a number of them that were very popular years ago with a number of the groups that used to get together and go on these bike trips over.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Mel, very good. Well, have you ever checked the Outbacker? Is it as bad as people say? Now, mounted in the trunk of my car, I've got the automatic tuner. It's an NZ wire. It's made to feed a wire that runs in tandem with the IC7000. And I have a short wire going over from that tuner to that ball mount. And the reason for the tuner is this why I don't have to set the antenna to an exact resonant point. Just bring it into the ballpark and, you know, resonate it with the tuner. Now, what occurred to me, because the antenna, the ball mount can't support it properly on 80 meters. The coil is too big. If you ever experimented with a 102-inch whip and a tuner in the trunk, and how does that compare to the Hustler? And did you ever play with the Outbacker? Get a note.
Okay, the antennas I have tried mobile. I have, do not use a tuner with the Hustler whip. As you know, it's a monoband whip, the monoband coils you put on it. I have tried a number of mobile antennas, screwdriver antenna. I don't remember if I tried the Outback. I tried a Diamond, I think, a model, I think, antenna. Whatever anybody had, you know, that I could borrow, because I've got the right mount there. I've got a universal adapters for my mount and all, you know, anything, because, you know, it's got the thread on it, that, 3H24 thread. So anything that'll thread into there, I could put an adapter on, I could try, you know, and just get comparison reports and then very easily put back the Hustler and, you know, get somebody cooperative that's especially interested in mobiling to give me, you know, really reports by ear, you know, just saying, you know, antenna A and I'm going to switch to a B, you know, that type of thing. So that's basically how I conducted it, and it seems like the Hustler whip came out tops every single time, Rich. No doubt about it. Hands down, the Hustler whip seems to be the one to go mobile with. What else did you say? You wanted to ask me something else about mobiling antennas. As far as I could say, using the Hustler, I've never seen a need, really, to use a tuner with it, Rich, over.
Okay, Mel. Did you ever find a problem with the flopping over with the 80-meter coil? And is it possible, I haven't seen them, to get one of the older ball mounts that's got the serrated teeth as opposed to these rubber gaskets? They don't... I've tried tightening that gasket as much as possible. You step on the gas and the thing flops over.
Well, what a lot of the guys were doing was the, you know, these heavier whips, some of them using those multi-coil whips, you see those spiders. They use little guy cords, you know, and they tie some cords onto it and go down like to the, and put these little brackets on, these little clamp-on brackets to the rain gutter edge, you know, or something of that sort. In other words, actually come up with a guying situation for the whip. Usually a two-point guy system works fairly well, Rich, over.
Okay, Mel. Very good. All right. I think I got my questions answered. Stick, let me turn it back to that. There's a KA2, I think it was YNR. It's a little noisy. Thank you very much. We'll catch you later, Mel, and pick back to you back to that in 2 weeks.
Very good, you guys. I think it was KA2IYY, India Yankee Yankee. Correct me, and give us your name, sir. Go right ahead.
Yellow Alpha 2 Yankee, India Yankee. My name is John. I'm wondering if you're using a monopole whip, what's serving as a counterpoise on a bicycle?
Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, I tried that. When I was fixed bicycle, I had my counterpoise that I'd roll out. One of the other guys in our club does that quite often. He goes over to the Parkway. That's Tony WW2W. He goes over to the Parkway with the bike, and he clamps on to the railing there. He pulls the bike right up to the railing and clamps on there. What a difference in the signal. He's done that several times with us on our little 10-meter get-togethers in the Sunday morning on 10 meters. So I've done that too. I roll out my braided and use that as my fixed counterpoise. I've never really rode with it, dragging it behind, to tell you the truth, Dick. So, no doubt would make an improvement on the use of that mobile whip on the bike, Dick. Over.
Pretty fine. I'm going to turn it back to John. John lives in Farmingdale. Farmingdale was my hometown. He lives on Staple Street, and Staple Street is close to where the school was that I used to go to. Back to you, John. K2YIY, K2RIW.
Yankee, India Yankee, puts you at Old Mill Road School,
doesn't it? In the old days, I think it was called the Weldon E. Howard High School. I'm not sure. I think that's what it was called. Go ahead.
At the middle school now, 6th through 8th grade. That was the question I had, just what service as a counterpoise on a mobile whip on a bicycle. Thanks.
Okay. Anywhere else with any further questions and comments on all that has occurred? Give us your call letters right now.
K2YL.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Something I tried to get in earlier when they were talking about powering, something that I thought of, I don't know if anybody has seen the Volkswagen solar cells. Volkswagen cars are shipped with a solar cell that suction cups to the windshield, which keeps the car's battery charged during shipping. And they're available on eBay. You can get them for probably 20 or 30 bucks. They're not that big, but they'll put out about 8 watts. That's not going to be able to power his whole radio, but that's at least progress towards it. On a bicycle, you're not worrying about wind speed, so you could probably mount this thing horizontally over the equipment area or something like that. So just a thought I would throw out.
Sounds kind of nice, Bernie. What do you believe is the price of that 8-watt solar cell system that's used on Volkswagen automobiles being shipped? Back to you, Bernie.
You can see them on eBay for a $20 to $30 range.
That's very nice. That's cheap enough, in fact, that you could buy a number of them and start stacking them together. And they're probably, grunt-type solar cells at something like 10% efficiency, which is not bad to begin with. Let's see, Mel, how's the mailbag been so far this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I was going to say something. We were talking about a lot of solar energy, I think we sort of brought up tonight. And I did a little solar project for the summer here. Very interesting little project I got involved with here. Just to whet my, curiosity, let's put it this way, as to what can I do with solar energy. And I decided this wasn't going to be for generating electric. This was for generating hot water. My neighbor next door, last year, the heating system for the pool, an in-ground pool, approximately 10,000 gallons. The in-ground pool is in the backyard, and of course, and the heating system there is, it was an expensive piece of equipment that was put in some years ago, went bad, and quite an investment to go ahead and to replace it at this point. And she says, "Oh, I haven't got the money. What do you think?" I says, "Let me take a shot at heating the pool up with solar energy." She says, "Do whatever you like." And I wound up thinking, because I happen to have a roll here of this black pipe that is used for burying underneath your lawn, for irrigating your lawn. It's a black plastic pipe. And I got a big roll of it, hundreds of feet of it. I made a big coil out of it, and I stick it, it's up against the wall of the house where the sun comes down quite strong all day long at a certain angle. And you'd be amazed, Dick, I heated the water in that pool this summer strictly with the sun over.
And was the circulation of the water by natural convection, or was there a small pump involved, Mel?
There's a little pump that we have. Now, what the little pump is for, when you close your pool during the winter, for the winter, you put this little pump down, and it's very small. It hasn't got very much capacity. And the idea is the water from rains and snows that accumulates on the cover starts to weigh the cover down. So it switches on, it's got a little float switch in it. It switches on this little pump, it's got a hose connected to it, and you pump the water out down your driveway or into your sewer or however. So all I did is put one end of the hose, have it sitting on the first step of the pool, and I have this connected to this coil via a hose, goes through this coil and then back via a hose adapters that I added on there right back to the pool. And the water, when that sun shines on there, you put your hand under that, I mean, you're not going to burn your hand, but that water, I'd say, is considerably hot, Dick, over.
So if I understand correctly, that pump is ordinarily pumping the water that from rain or whatever that falls on top of the pool cover. Is there any water in the pool itself at that time? And if so, if that water freezes, couldn't that possibly expand and do damage to the pool? Back to you.